Hello, welcome. This is a very anticipated interview here. I've got Dr. Stu McGill on the call, and I'm very excited to interview him. I posted a blog, what day was it? It was last week sometime, I believe on maybe Wednesday, and I asked people if they wanted to hear more about these topics, let me know, and there was an overwhelming response from people saying, please interview Stu. They want to hear what he has to say. So, just to set the stage, I went out there to Waterloo, Canada. I spent the day with Dr. McGill. We had a lot of great conversations, and we did some really nice experiments at his laboratory. So, without further ado, Stu, why don't you just tell the listeners a little couple sentences about who you are?
Who I am. Well, hi, Brett, first of all. I'm a professor of spine biomechanics, at least that's my official title. And how about that?
How many years have you been studying the spine?
I don't know, over 30.
Over 30 years of studying the spine. So, since you're going to be humble here, I would say Stu is regarded as the world's leading spinal biomechanist. And what's really nice is that Stu has a. You see some guys in the literature that, yeah, they might have advanced knowledge of the spine. Like with modeling or with the physics of it, but they don't understand the practical aspects of strength and conditioning and physical therapy, in which case that requires equal study, equal amount of study as the science and the mathematics and the physics. And so that's what makes Dr. McGill special. So I decided I'm just going to roll through the questions that I had listed on my blog. Because we talked about a lot of interesting things. So, first off, Stu, please tell the listeners, in college, what did you think you were going to do, and how did you discover your love of physics?
Well, I'm glad you're leading this, Brett, because I can't remember what we talked about. So, in my senile form, that I appreciate this.
Yeah, were you surprised at how much of it I remembered?
I have to say that I never saw you take one note, and yet you seem to recall all these serial topics. But nonetheless, what I thought I was going to do in university, I hadn't a clue. And this will be a fun story for you. Have you heard of this website, RateMyProfessor.com?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, in our program at the university, I'm the first professor that the students see at a high school in our program, and I happen to be the last. I sort of bookend the program. And a student was in my first lecture straight out of high school, September the 9th, or maybe it was the 13th, I can't remember. There was a new entry on Rate My Professor. This kid came out of high school and rated me with one lecture. No other context other than the high school experience, and apparently I suck. So there you go. But what I did say in that first lecture was, I told them, look, when I was in university, I had not a clue what I was going to end up doing, and it was just a bit of fate and a bit of karma that I was sitting there in math class in university, and I could not do math or physics to save my life in high school. And this professor came in and said, look, you don't need to understand limits to understand calculus. And that's where they started us in high school, and I was totally lost. And he said, it's basically how one variable changes as a function of another, distance and time or mass and something else. And all of a sudden, I could feel all these relationships in my hand. So these were magical quantum events for me, where I could suddenly understand the magic of math and physics and feel it in my hands. And I mean, as you know, we did talk. I know, looking at my body now, it's shameful, but I did at that time train fairly heavily, and was interested in sport performance for myself, of course. But I slowly just became more interested in physics. Do you want me just to finish off that library story?
Sure.
Yeah, I must have been lost one day, but I found myself in the university library, and there was a book on the table, Biomechanics, and I picked it up and started to thumb through it, and I thought, wow, this is a terrific fusion between anatomy, because I'd been taking the medical anatomy courses, and I quite enjoyed that, and physics. And so I applied for biomechanics at the University of Ottawa, and did my master's there, and went on.
Now, before you finished off your degree, did you assume you were going to be a carpenter, a plumber, or something like that, or did you?
Coming out of high school, I thought I was going to be a plumber. Yeah, that's true.
And so then you realized you have a knack and an affinity for physics, but at this point in time, you had no clue that you were going to go study the spine, correct?
No, that's correct. I went to university with no real interests other than football. But as it turned out, I was not a very good university footballer. And as you'll recall, but towards the end of my undergrad career, I got into road cycling and wanted to go to University of Ottawa so I could ride my bike up in the French Gatineau Hills in Quebec. And then for my PhD, not really.
Before that, before you get into your PhD, basically your father fell sick, correct? And then you needed to move home to be with him.
That is correct, yeah.
And then you moved home back to Waterloo. But at this point in time, that's when you met your future PhD supervisor, correct?
Well, it's sort of like that. My parents didn't live in Waterloo. They were outside, but I did come home to give my mother a hand. My father was in a wheelchair by this time. And I applied to the University of Waterloo for systems engineering, and I was going to work with a professor there who was interested in injury prevention. But then I was playing hockey for the professor's team at the University of Ottawa while I was doing my master's. And we happened to play the University of Waterloo. And there was a professor there named Bob Norman who played for Waterloo. And he was quite a hockey player when he was an undergraduate as well. In any case, we started the talk. And to make a long story short, he did become my actual PhD supervisor, but at that game, he invited me back to his place and said, you know, come to the Waterloo and visit. And by the way, you can process some of your data in my laboratory, because I was having a devil of a time. See, this was, computers weren't even invented yet. And I had taken films of people doing movements, and I was digitizing old movie film on a piece of graph paper and writing down the XY coordinates, believe it or not. And Bob had a machine that would play the film and it would electronically obtain the XY coordinates. So anyway, he was very kind. He invited me down to stay at his house. And I did. I finished off my master's and then switched my direction. He was just starting spine work. So together we started to work on the spine as a PhD student. So that was the story of how all that came. But you see, I think the moral of the story is it was really just dumb luck once again, meeting the right people at the right time, some good people, and just progressing.
Well, we see that a lot in probably every industry, but in the field of strength and conditioning, there are a lot of coaches who just stumbled into strength coaching and ended up being, but a lot of these people would have been good at whatever they chose to do, just because they have passion and talent. And I expect the same would be true for you. Okay. So moving on, the early work with Norman, I've gone back and read a lot of your original, papers from the early 90s and maybe some from the 80s, but some of your work with Norman, it seems like you two were out busting bro science. You guys were busting myths and misconceptions, and I always got the impression that this was indeed your supervisor, and he was kind of thrilled by your enthusiasm to go break down these doors. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that there were a lot of things that I've also read a lot of papers by spinal researchers at that time. For example, Serge Grajkowski, who is a very popular spinal researcher. And it's funny because having read enough of your stuff over the years, I can read some of Serge's stuff and go, okay, that's not accurate. In fact, I've read a couple of legendary papers by Grajkowski, including The Spinal Engine, where he basically talks about how the spine drives gait, and the spine is responsible for basically powering the walking mechanism. And then also a paper called The Optimum Spine, which is like this 55-page document. And pretty much piece by piece, you can take everything he wrote and kind of you've written papers saying otherwise. And so I kind of and so when I spoke to you, it was nice. I brought that up, and you guys used to butt heads a lot, correct?
Yeah, those were not at the time. It was quite stressful, but looking back now, it was a lot of fun, and I'll attribute much of my forging to some of those battles, if you will. Here's how that evolved. My PhD supervisor, Bob Norman, he was a very astute political fellow. He understood what drove science, how political forces, how social forces drive science. And he was interested in questions like, what's the number? What would a lawyer use to say this is a risky load on the body? And one of the first projects he assigned me was to use some of the simple spine models of the day to come up with some of these numbers, because he was being asked to be an expert witness in legal cases where, you know, the court wanted to know, was this a dangerous load or not? And the lawyers needed a number. And I would program some of these simple models with basically a jib crane, which is the spine, and then a single equivalent muscle representing the whole extensor complex. Well, you and I both know that's not anatomically accurate. It doesn't capture the co-contraction and abdominals and intra-abdominal pressure and the individual ways that the good movers perform a task and a poor mover might use a task. So this wasn't good enough for me. So I went back to Bob and I said, I don't believe these models. I think what I would like to do is create...
Stu, let me clarify that real quick. Essentially, they would take, correct me if I'm wrong, they would, the common process back then was to take kind of the average of the moment arms of the thoracic extensors and just estimate them and just generalize them to be like, say, 5 millimeters or something like that. Or what
exactly. The distance was a 5 centimeter moment arm. Yeah, that's
5 centimeter exactly. Moment arm. And yeah. You found that that was not correct, and that led to overestimation. And then also your PhD made it much more complex, and you basically looked at every single muscular tendinous unit and all the ligaments and every basically component that contributes to the forces on the spine, correct?
Exactly. Well, I wasn't a political animal back in those days. I was the guy who wanted to know why was a 62-year-old lady getting injured lifting boxes at the post office and a 22-year-old wasn't? Well, we sort of know why. Tissues were weaker. But was she doing other things that perhaps loaded the tissues closer to tolerance? And then you realize, boy, with all of this spectrum of biological variability, you can't come up with single numbers. This is politics that lawyers want these numbers. And well, we're going to get into some controversies that are later in my career. But getting back to the spinal engine and these theories of Dr. Grakovetsky, he was a brilliant engineer and very persuasive speaker. And he came up with his colleague, Harry Farfan at the time, who was a spine surgeon, theories on how the spine worked. And he would say things like, well, the muscles of the spine are not strong enough. Now, let's look at this power lifter picking up 400 kilo from the floor. There's no way the spine muscles are large enough. Therefore, there must be mechanisms that we do not understand or are in current models. So he came up with the lumbodorsal fascia theory, where the fascia gets stretched behind the muscles and takes some of the load and increases the mechanical advantage of the extensors and this sort of thing. But when I went at it with my model, I in those days had something like 96 slips of muscle, everything that crossed the low back. And if you take an MRI slice or a CT slice through the lumbar spine, you will see the lumbar musculature cut in cross-section, and you'll measure its size. But what you don't realize is that there's muscles all the way up the back that also contribute to that force. But when they're at the lumbar level through the layer of the scan, they're just a little tendon, so you can't see the muscle. So the fact that his models were ignoring all of this musculature and the latissimus dorsi, big lat muscles working through the fascia and whatnot, I didn't think it was anatomically accurate. And if you just captured the anatomy correctly, you didn't need these very esoteric explanations of how the back work. In fact, it became quite simplified. And then his ideas on, well, when we walk, we move the hips.
Well, Stu, before we get into the spinal engine, let me elaborate on that. I actually embedded a video in my blog probably 2 years ago because it was a video of Grakovetsky talking at the first fascial congress, and he brought that up, and he's a wonderful speaker, and he made a joke, and the whole audience erupted in laughter. And this just goes to show you how little people know about biomechanics and spinal biomechanics, because you could tell them anything and they'll believe it. But he said, if you look at what the muscles are capable of doing, it is a very small amount. So the lumbar fascia has to be contributing to, you know, stabilizing the back. But correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't he using, a smaller moment arm, and then also like the physiological cross-sectional area of ordinary people, not of powerlifters, correct?
I don't even think he captured ordinary people with enough fidelity for my satisfaction.
They were cadavers of elderly cadavers or something?
Well, I can't recall exactly where the data came from. But again, if you look at the whole spine and capture it, the statement that the muscles are not strong enough is patently wrong.
And you've talked about how the thoracic extensors are great stabilizers of the lumbar spine because of their longer moment arms. Correct?
Boy, if we get into a study or a conversation on stability, do you want to spend 3 or 4 minutes on that?
We'll get into that later. So essentially, a lot of the stuff he was talking about at the time, one by one, you would kind of pick it off. And this talk about the spinal engine real quick, because I remember reading that going, that just doesn't make sense. And it's very, like you said, esoteric and elusive. And it's, and I will tell you, people in our industry are drawn to this. And he talked about how if you take a metal rod and you bend it, and then if you twist it, it creates, you know, if you side bend it, it creates rotational torque, and that's what drives gait. Now, what are the problems with that?
Well, the problem is that's true for a rod made of fiberglass or graphite or something like that. So let's replicate the motions that he's showing in his graphite rod in a real person. What you have to do is walk swinging your hips, rolling each hip over. Well, when you measure people, there are some people who have totally the opposite pattern in their hips. In other words, their spinal engine is in reverse, and yet they're still able to walk forward. Now, here was, I remember being at a spine meeting one time, and Gunnar Anderson, who's a very well-known spine surgeon and scientist out of Chicago, he stood up and said, yes, but this patient right over here, they've had a fusion from L1 down to the sacrum. Their spine is stuck in neutral. It cannot move. Does that mean they can't walk? Now, the fact that then the room erupted in laughter the other way. But the point being is that you have big leg muscles for a reason, and that's how you walk.
The hips are the and it's the hips engine in most situations.
Thank you. So, I thought you might appreciate that.
Okay. So because of your work with Norman, and he was at the time trying to please the political powers, creating things like what are the maximum compressive loading limits and things like that, which are very vague. But you wanted your PhD thesis. You wanted to know everything that contributed towards towards these loads, correct? So, what was your thesis on?
Well, my thesis, the first objective was to build the most biophilic, anatomically accurate model of the spine ever done before. That was the objective. The reason for that objective was twofold. Number one, understand how the spine works with all of the pressures and muscles and ligaments and decrees of freedom of movement and everything else. So that was the first reason why I did it. And then the second one was, now could I understand injury mechanisms? What are the conditions that are required to create a herniated disc or a fractured M plate or torn ligaments or whatever the injury was? And that's pretty much that was the motivation for the thesis. And that model, as you know, we still use today. So, of course, it's much more anatomically robust than ever now. But we use it to create a foundational knowledge of how the spine works. And then we can ask clinical questions like, what was the injury mechanism and how can we best rehabilitate that injury mechanism? Or how did that person not achieve the performance, or how did that person achieve super performance? What was the mechanism there? And if we can quantify that, we can then figure out better ways to train it.
So most people, it's almost comical in my field. They'll say, take the bar off of your back for a week, and so you have no spinal loading. So you have no compressive loading. It's good to not do squats and deadlifts for a week, just to unload your spine. But what they don't realize is that most of spinal loading is created by the muscles, not the effects of the bar working through the body. It's the muscles themselves contracting and creating joint forces. So, and it's not just muscles. All tissues can create loading. So if you bend over and the ligament gets pulled tight, then it's going to create compressive forces as well. And so you basically create a model that would look at all the different tissues and would partition the different tissues. If you have a certain amount of forces, it would tell you where the forces are coming from, which muscles, which ligaments, and which different structures, correct?
Yeah, you've stated it quite eloquently. In the first description of it is, you have a very accurate description of the anatomy, these blocks of bone held together by discs and ligaments. So as you move that spine, we're not even talking about muscles yet. As you move that spine out of its elastic equilibrium, which is its rest neutral position, the ligaments tighten up. And as they tighten up, they impose forces on the various skeletal parts of the spine. Now, then we do what's called stress mapping. So we know the tolerance or the strength in the various modes, compression, bending, shear, torsion, twist, tension, etc., of the various bony elements. And then as the stresses develop in these passive tissues, the ligaments and the disc, they stress the connections of the bones. And then we just map it and watch when the applied load gets close to breaking tolerance of that particular bony element or disc element or whatever it happens to be. So that's the first bit of it, and that's why you saw our infrared system where we create an avatar of the person. We create a skeletal avatar so that as that person moves in 3D, our skeleton now moves in 3D, driven by their own personal movement patterns.
Well, let's elaborate on that. So for the listeners out there, if you go to my blog, the blog post I wrote, there are pictures of me. And first of all, Stu, I wish you hadn't taken me out to breakfast and had me order the biggest breakfast in the menu.
And my that's where we take our big athletes when they come in for testing. I've got to feed these boys, so I take
my stomach's bulging out. I was embarrassed, but anyway, you can see. But no, the deadlift picture was good. I looked very strong because it's hiding my belly, but the other one wasn't. And if I knew you were taking the picture, I would have sucked in. But anyway, you see me hooked up to a bunch of electrodes and motion sensors. And then with, for example, the deadlift picture, you can see I'm standing on a force plate. You can see cameras around the room. So the cameras are using infrared they detect the sensors on my body. And that creates that 3D avatar. So you can look at the computer screen and see. It's like the movies. It's like you see in those the whatever you call it, animation or whatever, where I look like a robot, and it's kind of funny because I could see it was my physique. I have these big adductors, and I could tell it was my own personal physique there. And that models, and that picks up your joint motions. You're standing on a force plate. That's detecting the forces on the force plate, the vertical and horizontal and lateral forces that are put into the ground as you perform an exercise. And then all the electrodes are sensing the electrical activity of the muscles, and this is all fed into that model that Stu was discussing, this anatomically accurate model of all the parts of the body with the spine, the vertebrae, the discs, the ligaments, the muscles, the fascia, and that's all blended together to tell you the forces, so you can get a ton of different data out of that. If I do a deadlift, you can get the EMG of the muscles. You can get the spinal motion, the hip motion. You can get you can calculate the spinal forces. And there's only a few laboratories in the world that can do this. So that's why I felt so privileged to be there, because this is, the only other laboratories I think are in other continents. So I was very privileged to be there. So that kind of explains this method, the McGill method, if you will. Is that what you would call it, Stu?
Well, on our real live person side, yeah, I think I took you into some of our labs where we actually take spines and create the injuries. That's a whole different technology as well. But certainly for that lab that we tested you in, that's what it does. I'll send you some of your avatars when they get fully up with the full stress mapping done. You can put them on your website if you want.
It would be hilarious to see a robotic
or look at Brett inside.
Yeah, robotic hip thrust or a robotic deadlift. Okay, so moving on.
Just so your listeners know, that's exactly the same technology that was used to make the movie Avatar, and and you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, when they have all the zombies walking, those are actors driving their avatars with their motion that those 3D infrared cameras pick up, and then they create the skeleton, and then you render the muscles on and activate the muscles with the EMG. So it really is light years beyond an MRI or a CT or anything like that, because it's 3D, and as the person activates their muscles, we measure that activation profile through the EMG and convert that to force, attach those forces to the skeleton, do the stress analysis, and most importantly, we go far beyond that, and we even measure variables such as joint stability. So when we hear about, oh, this stabilizes the spine, well, does it really? Because I find a lot of people talk through their hat, their hand waving, saying, oh, this is a spine stabilizing mechanism, when it may very well be destabilizing.
Awesome. So we're going to get, in a few questions, we'll talk more about the EMG aspect of that. But you worked with powerlifters early on, correct? Was this the 80s or 90s?
No, that was still, well, we worked with all sorts of people, but I have a sneaky suspicion where this conversation is going is to the, that's middle 80s now, and a lot of the top Canadian powerlifters happen to be training in Kitchener. Are we going to talk about the ATSIC stories here?
Well, basically what I want people to know is that you're not just some lab geek who always just stayed in the lab. You have seen world-class deadlifts. You have worked with strong powerlifters and strong men. You've worked with incredible athletes. You've seen it all, and I think that's important because I don't really trust someone if they haven't. If they're going to make comments about, you know, athletic, about, you know, movement and things like that, it's important that you've been around the block and seen, you know, and worked firsthand with these people. And if you were working with powerlifters in the 80s, that just goes to show you, you know, 30 years of working with, you know, alongside of the powerlifters and the athletes, because your initial work was mostly focused on injury prevention with, like, for example, occupational workers. And then over your career, you've seen more of a transition into working with more of the athletes in the strength and conditioning field.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that, again, not all of this was by design. Some of it was by just happenstance. I mean, as you know, I get asked to consult and see athletes from around the world. I don't even see local people. Every patient I see flies in, and they come now from all sorts of sports. And I guess I've got this little reputation of if someone has a painful back, I can usually give them some advice in how to train around whatever the cause is, and see if we can create a performance enhancing program that will restore their backs and get them back to competition. And I think, you know, trolling the internet or again, I can't talk about individual names, obviously, because it's medical confidential information. But there's quite a few people who have told their stories where we got them back to the Olympics or back in the NFL or back in the UFC or whatever that their sporting endeavor was. So we took them from a state of being unable to train because of their disabling back pain to the point where they could, well, some of them be elite performers in the world of virtually every Olympic sport, you know, rowing, weightlifting, the combatives, track and field, kayaking,
basketball.
No, well, certainly I've consulted with a number of NBA basketball organizations for sure. Well, anyway, I'll stop that. But
now, yeah. Were you always comfortable when people came to you for advice as a practitioner, were you always comfortable giving advice?
No, I was scared silly. No, yeah, I mean, look, you got it. I was trained as a scientist, not a clinician. And I would be asked to go to scientific meetings, different, you know, say a neurology meeting or an orthopedics meeting or a sports medicine meeting. And some of the docs would say, you know, that's really interesting, the mechanism that you just showed for that injury and the recovery and whatnot. Would you see a difficult patient for us? This patient is foxing us. And I would say, no, I don't see patients. And they'd say, well, it's okay. We'll be with you. Would you come and see this patient with us and show us how you think and how you interpret what you see? So that's how I started, working side by side with them, and then slowly realizing that what I was able to see and understand because of what I was seeing about the mechanics associated with pain and elite performance and all that sort of thing, I gained confidence to just see people on my own. So how it works now is if an athlete or a disabled back wants to see me, I send them a package, which is an information package with travel instructions and all that sort of stuff. And then I need a referral letter from the referring physician. And it will say, you know, please see so-and-so for mechanical back pain. Here are some of the peculiarities that you should know. There might be a contraindication for a certain type of exercise or a blood pressure or something like that. And then I see the person. It takes me 3 hours. At least I set aside 3 hours for an assessment, which includes pain provocation. So I am able to identify the triggers of their pain in terms of very specific motions, postures, and loads. And then to design a program for them to avoid their painful triggers. That's number one. I don't do corrective exercise or anything off the bat. The very first thing I do is remove the cause. And then we devise a corrective exercise program and then full on training. And, you know, it makes me laugh sometimes when, you know, people say, oh, we did the McGill exercises. And I say, what in the hell are the McGill exercises? And they say, well, it's the bird dog. And I said, have you ever read my books or do you know what we do? We have people picking hundreds of pounds off the floor and throwing men around the room. The McGill exercises, a bird dog. Anyway, it's quite comical sometimes.
Well, it's funny you talked about purposely provoking their pain to find out what are the mechanisms that cause pain and then telling them to avoid that. That's so simple and so often overlooked. I can't tell you how many people come to me and they say, it hurts when I do this. One of my favorite articles ever written in strength and conditioning was an article that Mike Boyle wrote. And I think the title was, If It Hurts, Don't Do It. And he talked about the same thing. And now that I'm more popular on the internet, I get all these emails from people saying it hurts when I do this. And I'll say, then don't do that. You know, don't do that. It's just, it's too common sense for them. And
you know the tragedy of that is, Brett, though, you know, when I get a person, I'm never the primary contact. I'm farther down the tree. They've already been to 10 different docs. And I'll say to them, has any of those docs ever asked you to show them how you create the pain? And they'll say no. And I think, man, what an indictment of medical practice, or at least of the people who they saw. They failed to try and understand the cause of that person's pain.
Well, I can't even. That's a whole other podcast. I can't tell you how many people come to me and say, my so and so, my doctor, my physical therapist, my personal trainer says I have a weak core. And okay, did he test your core? Did he what exercise did he give you to? And it's just that person was using buzzwords, and the person is gullible. They'll believe anything. It could be that they have too strong of a back, and they're trying to use their back for everything. It doesn't always mean just because you have back pain that you have a weak core. A lot of times it's not your strength, it's your movement patterns, and you have the strength. You just need to learn to move differently or something. But Okay, moving on.
Can I just follow that up? Because what you said is so wise for the listenership. You know, may I have 5 minutes or 1 minute on that?
Yeah, of course.
We've done enough of populations. We've done sporting groups. We've done factory workers. We've done lines distribution, guys who climb hydro poles, for example. And it keeps coming back over and over and over again that strength as a single variable does not prevent back pain. And I'm using that very generically because there's all kinds of back pain. But what happens is if you think you're going to get rid of back pain by getting a stronger back, you might be in that category of person, but that's not the common pattern. The common pattern of people who get back pain have almost too much strength and a movement pattern that causes that stress concentration at the area where the pain is. And it's almost incumbent upon every strength and conditioning professional that if you add strength to a person, the pattern better be there so you don't create a stress concentration. And Gray Cook, as you know, he preaches that till the cows come home. Anyway, you have been preaching it as well. If you have a lot of strength, you've got to have control. If you have a lot of strength, you've got to have a certain amount of endurance, because that strength has to be harnessed over and over and over again with every repetition. People get hurt when they break form. They don't get hurt when they pick 800 pounds off the ground, if they do it well. But when you talk to them, no, it was the one that I wasn't paying attention on, and I dropped, you know what I'm trying to say.
And I can't tell you how many times over the last, and it's funny because I've been lifting weights for, since I was, it's funny, a friend on email just reminded me about my on Facebook. He said, remember when we went to this gym? I wrote him back, said, how old were we? 15 years old. So I've been lifting now for 22 years, and I'm just finally, learning, to listen to my body. And over the last 5 years in particular, and if you just learn to listen to your body, I can't tell you how many times in the past decade where I got hurt and my body was screaming at me, giving me warning signs. And you just have to listen to biofeedback and learn when to push it, when to hold back, and when to pay attention to what form feels better and what form doesn't, because your body's good at giving you warning signals,
Yeah, well, I've been lifting weights for double the length of time you have, but I don't know why I said that, but I'll just mention this because you'll appreciate it. You're familiar with
Mark. Because you were big timing me, Stu. You just wanted to throw that.
Yeah. No, it's quite the opposite. You young bucks, I'm trying to keep up to, but my old body just doesn't hang in there anymore. But you've probably heard of Marty Gallagher.
Yep.
Yeah, one of the grand old men of powerlifting. And Marty, if you ever listen to this, he's going to bust me for calling him an old man. But in any case, Marty's older than I am. But do you know Marty has picked up 500 pounds off the floor for five consecutive decades?
That's great.
Now, you listen to him, because he'll tell you how you manage that. And yet, both you and both I will take a lot of flack from kids on the internet who are anonymous, saying we don't know this and we don't know that. And I think, man, I think I should be listening to the guy who's done it for five decades.
Well, that leads us into next question. You mentioned to me that it's hard, Stu, because sometimes I would kill to be in your position where you don't have a blog and you don't have to deal with blog comments, Facebook. Like me, I have Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, email, text messages, and I've got these things flying at me all day. And sometimes I go, God, I'd kill to just be. My supervisor, John Cronin, laughed at me and said, man, I'm, there's something nice about being inaccessible. But you aren't as your work is. People will hear snippets of things you say, and then it'll blow up into this thing. Whereas if they were to talk to you about it, they would see there's a more of a common ground that people don't get to see.
Well, there's a lot of mythology and misunderstanding and the quotes that I keep hearing over and over again. But do you want a reaction to that?
Sure.
Yeah, it reminds me of the old kid's school ground. You know, one kid says something to another kid and it starts a rumor. The next kid passes it on and it gets slightly translated. Then the next kid passes it along. So by the time the person gets it fourth hand, it resembles nothing like the original bit of gossip. And I think that's what happens on the internet. So now, you know, there's this thing. Apparently McGill thinks there's a number of bends that hurt the back, or there's a load that hurts the back. And, you know, again, they just don't know what they're talking about. I talked about that whole political process. And if they realized there is a branch of the American government called NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and they go around and ask experts their opinions on strategies to protect the American worker. Well, they have single number limits, they're called TLVs, threshold limit values, for things that hurt Americans. You know, there's one for radiation exposure, for example. Now, there's a limit that if you're exposed occasionally, there's a limit that if you exceed the limit, it's legal negligence. And there's another limit that you must never expose an American worker to X amount of radiation. But you see, it's a single number. Now, that single number might not hurt one person who's not very sensitive to it, and it might really hurt someone else. Or another example are the nutritional guidelines put out by the government, where there's a daily healthy dose of, say, vitamin D or vitamin C or whatever it is. But these are all values. Now, what person is average? The answer is nobody. It doesn't fit anybody. Now, people will be surprised to know that NIOSH has a single number limit for low back compression. That limit, if you're exposed over and over again, it happens to be 4,300 newtons. So now let's go to the post office. There's a 62-year-old lady at the post office humping boxes, and there's a 22-year-old big, strong guy lifting boxes. Do they have the same tolerance? No. Is the amount of load that their body can take the same? No, it's not even close. But the American political system will not allow the discrimination between old and young and male and female and all the rest of it. But we all realize that biologically it's ludicrous. So when I have made a statement, it's at the request of a body to come up with an average number based on a lot of science and a lot of perspectives, and it's not pigs and it's not an animal and it's not... It comes from many, many different perspectives. So that got translated through that schoolyard banter to the next person who wrote something on the internet. McGill wrote a number, but they had no idea of the political context and gravity of when that statement was made. And so now it's go through the internet. You know, Brett doesn't know what he's talking about. McGill doesn't know what he's talking about because of that one number, and they are just totally unaware of the process of it all. So,
Stu, the higher up you get, the more popular you get, the more you have to deal with it. It's when I had my blog, when there were, you know, a couple years ago, I had a fourth of the readership that I have now, and I flew under the radar. But now I get, you know, anything I say, I get hammered for it. I feel like if someone misinterprets it. So I definitely understand there. But, not trying to cut you off, but you mentioned the 4,300, the NIOSH compressive loading limits. And I have a folder of research involving compressive loading and also shear loading. And some of the, well, I think the highest I've ever seen is a deadlift. And this, I think, was this Callahan, your student, who published this paper? But it was on deadlifts, and I think it was 23,000 newtons of compression.
No, it was Yatsik. Now his name is it looks like Chalowicki if you read it.
Oh yeah, Chalowicki, that's right.
Chalowicki, but he's Polish. It's actually pronounced Holowicki. But anyway, no, he was my first PhD student.
Now there was a paper before that from Granhead, that showed like 35,000 newtons, but that was they used a different moment arm. So the Chola Wiki, however you pronounce it, paper was more accurate.
No, however, no. I'd listen to Grand Head as well, because the loads lifted these days are a lot more than the loads lifted in those days.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you think of Andy Bolton deadlifting 1,000 pounds or Benedict Magnuson deadlifting 1,000 pounds, I would think that they would have more of the lines of maybe 40,000 newtons of compression.
You're right on.
And this just goes to show you what you said earlier. You know, you can build up the body to be very strong, the muscles, and as long as you hold good position and you know, like don't, if your training parameters are proper, your frequency, your volume, your load, your postures, all these things, you can build your body up to withstand that. So the body is a very impressive unit if you train properly.
Some people can.
Oh, well, that's what I would like to talk about. Why? Okay, I'm going to veer off. You have mentioned genetics as it pertains to the spine. So talk for a second about, and I'm veering off, I know this is a question later on. Talk about the ovoid and the Limacon disc shapes.
Yeah. Well, just let me preempt that by saying, oh, McGill learns everything from pig spines, which again just annoys me to no end. It's about we use maybe, I don't know what, 10% of our publications in medical journals use animal models, but we have to use animal models to answer the question that you just posed. So I can't get 50 identical human spines. They don't exist. But we can raise 50 identical pigs, at least from genetic material. And anyway, if you the pig neck, the pig roots for food. It has a very robust lumbar spine in its neck. It can't move it very much. And the fact that it has to hold its head up, it's cantilevered, it's a quadruped, the head is out in front of the body. All the time it has to turn on its extensor muscles just to hold its head up. So when you look at the architecture of a pig neck, if I showed a pig neck or some vertebra to a surgeon, to a human surgeon, and we do this in the lab, they come in, they don't know whether it's a pig C4 or a lumbar C4 out of a human. They're that close. So people don't realize that. But anyway, what the animal models allow us to do is we can have a variety of disc shapes, and we inherit that from our parents. So if you take a slice through your low back, you will look down in a bird's eye view and see the shape of your disc. Now some are oval. If you twist, an oval disc likes to twist. So the great golfers, not all of them, but they tend to have oval shaped discs simply because of survival of the fittest. If you can't swing a club very well and you can't twist, you're going to choose another sport besides golf. So people with these slender ovoid discs tend to become golfers. Those types of spines can twist. Now, if you take the archetypical middle linebacker from the NFL, they don't have ovoid discs. They, by definition, to survive in that sport, have to take a lot of compression, and they have much bigger, thicker, bigger radius discs, but they're shaped like a lima bean when you look down on them. They're big, and they indent at the back where the spinal canal is. Now, when you get a thin branch and you bend it, it'll bend. There's not much stress. But if you take a thick branch and bend it, it breaks. And that's what happens with very thick discs that tend to be Limacon shaped. The hydraulic stresses that come from bending in big, heavy spines get focused to the back of the curve of the Limacon. And these kinds of people end up with posterior lateral disc bulges. If they bend too much.
Stu showed me this in his lab. He had an example of each, and he could show the herniating mechanism.
Right. Are you getting a beep on Skype here? Oh, there it goes.
Yeah, it went away.
Yeah, I think we're clear now. Anyway, I hope I'm making my point in that we all have different spines. So, you know, when we're looking at the physical performance from a person's back, it depends on its shape. If they have a big, thick spine, chances are they shouldn't be doing hundreds of sit-ups. In fact, they can't. The stresses would accumulate, and they damage their backs. But if you take a thin person who's, you know, they naturally gravitate to yoga and these kinds of things, they can bend their spine around with relatively little stress and very little chance of harm. So, again, you know, when I get quoted, there's a certain number of bends, it depends entirely on who the person is. So when we're consulting with a particular athlete, we examine all these features and try and converge on the most common sense approach, depending on the shape of their disc and previous injury patterns. For example, if we see a tear in the annulus of the disc, I can almost bet that that's a twisting injury in their spine. Then we look for that pattern and try and help them to remove it. But if it's a very focal disc bulge, that's probably an anterior bending injury. Anyway, genetics.
One thing that I always was, if you read a lot of the work of, who is it, Dolan? Is it Michelle? Is that the right name? There's a lot of spinal research that talk about heredity.
There's two people who do that. There's Michelle Battier at the University of Alberta that has a lot to say about genetics and particular types of back disorders. Now, Trish Dolan is at the University of Bristol in England. Adams and Dolan.
Well, they'll tell you that, you know, I've seen estimates as high as 85% or something like that of your, but what was interesting to me when I was doing a ton of spinal research a few years back was all these different chemicals. So you talked about the anatomy of, you know, how genetic anatomy can affect spinal durability, but there's also physiological genetic, and I wouldn't even just say genetic because I bet you lifestyle can affect this a lot as well, but there's all sorts of chemicals, and I can't remember all the names, but there's like metalloproteinases that can wreak havoc on disc health. There's a lot of anabolic chemicals like IGF-1 and things, or like I can't remember all the names of them, but I wrote them down at one point. There were like 11 different chemicals I had written down that can have, you know, therapeutic or anabolic healing, repairing effects, and then there's other chemicals that can break the disc down. And different individuals probably have varying percentages of these as well, and so that probably has a lot of influence over spinal health and durability. Would you agree?
I'd absolutely agree that they have a biological spectrum. And that they can cause different rates of repair in different people. The total ability of them to create total repair, so to speak, or how influential they are, that might become a question for debate. They will not be the dominant factors in whether your back pain gets better or not is my position at this time. They will have smaller effects, but if you can't get rid of the cause, or if you've flattened a disc, there's not a hell of a lot those chemicals are going to do to restore the height of the disc.
But if you, I guess what I'm trying to say is if they have whatever the injury, whether it's shear-related, compressive-related, bending-related, if they're only doing it every, you know, few days or once a week or twice a week, but they have good reparation systems, they might never that injury may never appear versus someone else who does not have. For example, smoking can affect the disc physiology. Am I right about that?
To a very small degree, yeah.
But the reason why I'm saying this is it's not pure physics. It's the word biomechanics implies that there's the physics, but there's a biological component as well. There's a living component.
You're absolutely right, but let's just go back to that the point you just made, because that was a very important one, that you can build a little bit of cumulative trauma and then the disc will repair if you leave sufficient time and then have another cycle of loading. So, you know, in some sort of interval training situation, you want to be careful with that assumption. The muscles absolutely will follow the law that you just described. The collagenous tissues, yes, but not quite so well. The disc, even poorly still. So building trauma, delaminating the collagen in the disc will not repair in a week, and it may not even repair in a year. It's that slow. So folks need to understand, I think, that be very careful with the cumulative loading. Now, I'm not talking about pristine good movement. The spine is really quite robust if you load it say you're putting high load on it. The very best thing you can do, the safest common sense thing you can do, is keep it in a neutral position with high load. If there's not high load, I'm not so worried about it, unless you've already got an injury and now sitting is painful and a certain sitting posture bothers you, then you better not sit in it. But if the spine has no cumulative load, that's a very common sense wise practice. But to do a little bit of bad form and then think you'll take a few days off and then do the same thing once again, that will accumulate and it will come back to haunt you.
So moving on, earlier we talked about EMG. A lot of spinal models, they don't utilize EMG, and they just make assumptions that, you know, you do a squat lift or something or a stoop lift, and they just look at joint torques. Now, you can get the net joint torques, but you're making assumptions about the muscles. Why is it critical to throw EMG into the mix, to incorporate muscle activation into that model?
Because we all use different motor strategies to accomplish a task. When you were in the lab a couple of weeks ago, we tried a few little training interventions. We tried internal-external rotation of the hips. We tried some little strategies to see if we could migrate muscle activity between the glutes and hamstrings. So we did all of this. We're able to do that because we were measuring your neurology while we were doing it. We were measuring the personal differences in your muscle patterns. Those are all going to create very different joint loads. So we then have the ability to say, you know, Brett, for you, if that exercise tool was to achieve this goal, that was a wiser exercise. That this other one, this variant, might have been a poorer choice, because not only did it achieve the activation level that you did not want, but it also, you paid a hell of a penalty for doing so by having a very high joint load. So that's why EMG is so important, to pick up the individual differences.
So for example, if I do a squat lift, for example, I do a heavy squat. I've heard a lot of experts claim that the squat and the deadlift are the best abdominal exercises that you can do. In which case, I just know they've never measured EMG, because there's exercises that, for example, an ab wheel rollout, that will so far exceed the activity of the abdominal and oblique muscles that you get in a squat and deadlift. However, that aside, let's say it was the best abdominal exercise and you had to, those placed the greatest challenge on your abdominal muscles, would that not, luckily that's not the case, because if so, in order to keep spinal stability, now you have co-contraction, which stabilizes. However, if you are creating a flexion moment with your abdominals, if you're actually crunching down with the abs and not bracing, the more you activate your abdominals and erectors, the more your erectors have to do now to stabilize the spine, to prevent flexion of the spine. So two questions here. If you just were if you didn't look at EMG and you just looked at joint torques, you might assume that this person is performing optimally because maybe their net joint, maybe their spine stayed neutral and they aren't, so you just assume that, hey, their spine stayed neutral, all is fine. But you might find that they are so highly activating their core muscles that they're creating tremendous joint forces, tremendous spinal loading, which is unnecessary if it's, say, a lighter load. And so that's, for me, that's one reason why EMG is critical, because you can look at the co-contractions. And when you co-contract, you increase stability, but you also, that comes at a penalty with increased joint loading. But talk about that real quick, Stu. Do you want to activate the abdominals to their greatest possible degree when you do simple tasks?
No, of course not. I think the term you're looking for is called sufficient stability. You need just enough to accomplish the task without the spine buckling. Well, I need to get into that stability concept in terms of mechanism to really answer this question. But the short answer is you need just sufficient stability. Any more would be silly. You're just crushing yourself.
So when you hear people say, squeeze your abs as hard as possible, that's not the wisest strategy, depending on the situation.
I think you're dealing with someone who's very crude.
Okay, so you had mentioned a very cool story to me. You were on the path to, you were limping. And this was in your 30s? You were limping. You had some calcification, on your labrum. You had some growth on your labrum. You were limping, and you were on your way to get hip replacement surgery. And you took matters into your own hands. You started exercising, performing certain exercises. And that spur on your labrum diminished, your posture improved, and you prolonged. You have not gotten hip replacement surgery. So that was a very cool story because you took matters into your own hands. So can you describe to me what you did and what mechanisms would cause that your labral growth to at your hip to improve itself, because that's you don't see that too often, I wouldn't think.
Yeah. Well, the story starts, I broke my hip, and if you look at it on an x-ray, instead of there being a nice femoral head, it looks like half a ping pong ball, but it's the inner half, the medial half, that is just a fat pad. So the joint itself was quite unstable, and it became quite arthritic. And it was about when I was 45 years old, I was starting to really have terrible hip pains, and the hip socket, the acetabulum, was growing nasty spurs all around it, like little teeth almost, so that when I extended, when I walked, one of these spurs would poke the femur, and it would cause me to lurch forward and limp. And people who knew me when I was in my 40s knew I had quite a nasty limp. Anyway, I arranged a hip replacement with one of my surgical colleagues, and I thought, oh, what the hell, I might as well just exercise the hell out of the hip because it's going into the garbage bin anyway, and get myself in the best possible shape for post-surgery recovery. And it was at that time, it was a very magical time in that we were talking earlier about serendipity and how you meet people and they change your life in funny little ways. At that time, I'd met Vladimir Yonda, who I think you're very familiar with his work.
Yep.
And Yonda was talking about, you know, this cross-pelvis syndrome where hip pain and back pain inhibits the gluteal muscles and facilitates the psoas. And when I measured this on myself, with the MG in the model, by the way, it turned out to be very, very true. And then Shirley Sarman came along, and I did a little bit of work with her at the time. And these are all, you know, just brilliant, insightful clinicians. And her work was showing that as Yonda said, if you have hip pain or back pain, your glutes become inhibited, so you become hamstring dominant. So when you get out of a chair and do squats or get off the toilet or any of those functional things, you tend to extend the hip with the hamstrings, leaving the glutes out of the motor control picture. Well, what Shirley Sarman's group found, and I'm trying to think of her lead researcher on that, and I'm embarrassed that I just...
It was Lewis.
It was Lewis. Thank you. Brett, you got a mind like a trap. Thank you, sir. it was Lewis and Sarman, and I think Gombato and Van Dillen were on the collection of works as well. But in any case, when you use the hamstring to extend the hip, it pulls, because of its line of action, it pulls the femoral head posteriorly. Sorry, it pulls it anteriorly and creates an anterior femoral impingement, with which a lot of deep squatters will be familiar with. However, if you can get the gluteals reintegrated back into the motor pattern, and you become gluteal dominant once again, it pulls the femoral head back out of anterior impingement. Well, I started doing hip thrusts and glute bridges and these kinds of things. But I will remember now, I was coached by Yonda, the brilliant clinician, teaching me to squeeze my glutes a certain way, push my feet away to activate the quadriceps and further inhibit the hamstrings and all of these bridges. I didn't use heavy load. It was all about repatterning the interplay between glutes and hamstrings. Now, at the same time, I started to take glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM, and a few of these cartilage builders. And then at the same time, I started to get, you'll notice my physique went much more skinny in that decade. And that was all purposeful, because all of a sudden my hips started to get better, and I set a goal for myself. Oh, if I can only reach 50 years of age with my own hip, that means, you know, because replaced hips only have a finite length of time, and I'm pretty active. I'll beat up that hip, and it'll be, you know, if it lasts 10 years in me, a fake hip, that wouldn't that would be all I could get. So anyway, my objective was to make 50. Well, I started to get close to 50, and lo and behold, my hip was getting better, and people thought I had a hip replacement. Then, you know, with our x-ray, I can, you know, with my colleagues and whatnot, x-ray my own hip, and I was watching the bone spurs shrink. So the more gluteal dominant I became, the better biomechanics of the hip joint was created, and it took away the femoral impingement. My labrum settled down. The hip spurs decreased, and the cartilage thickened. Now I'm skinny. What am I, 56? And I think I am. I have to do the arithmetic. And I still have my own hip. And I don't limp very much at all. Now, anyway, there's a little bit of a cool story for the glute guy.
Well, it's so cool because... in our field, there's a lot of talk about how you never want to use internal cueing internal intentional focus. You never want to tell people to focus on the muscles. They should always be focused on the external environment. And here you have a case where you did focus on building that mind-muscle connection to the glutes, and you repattern, and in your language, you reestablished gluteal dominance and brought the glutes back into the motor pattern, and it changed the biomechanics of your lumbopelvic hip complex. Now you've got glutes, pulling rearward on the femur, keeping it more centered in the acetabulum, and you aren't getting that impingement, and now you aren't getting the pain. And pain inhibits muscle activation, so just getting rid of the pain is huge, so you can keep using your glutes and they aren't inhibited. And it's prolonged your, because a lot of people don't realize this. I didn't realize this until you told me. Hip replacement surgery is a big deal because they only last around 10 years, and so you've got to get another one. Well, you have to spike that hip replacement into the femur, and so you can only do so about twice. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you lose so much bone stock the second time around because they have to bust out the first implant.
Yeah, so this has greatly impacted your life for the better, and it's just such a cool story. Now, I think you also, it's the frequency. You did this every day. You would be doing your glute exercise, your hip thrust and bridges, but also I have heard from other interviews that you also will get down to a deep full squat. Now, you aren't using weight, and you might go into a posterior pelvic tilt, but you're squatting all the way down and just keeping that ability. You're not using weight, but you're just going as deep as possible to retain that ability. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you're right on. Again, I'll tell another story. So the listenership is starting to appreciate that these brilliant people have fantastic influences on my life. So there's Yonda, there's Sarman. Now the next one is a fellow named Jerzy Gregorek. He was a Polish weightlifter. He now lives in California. He wrote the book called The Happy Body, which is a really wonderful read. But Jerzy is a former Olympic lifter. I think he has 3 or 4 world records. So he's very, very competent. Now, we used to discuss the old sort of Soviet bloc and Polish weightlifting routines. And he said, let me have a look at your hip. And this would have been, we met at Craig Levinson's place originally. That probably was, again, right when I was in my, no, this would have been after Yonda. So I'd still be in my 40s. And Jerzy said, I'm going to give you some advice with that hip. Do one deep squat every day. And I said, Jerzy, that'll turn me into a cripple. And he said, try it. And he said, don't use any load, hold on to a pole or a table and keep your body vertical and go down. And then when you get to the bottom, sink into it. Let all muscle tension go. So get into the deep squat and just go and sit into it, take all the tension out. And after a few days, I started to feel, again, a change, and it was a change for the better. So my hip, with what's left of it now, I can't squat with a bar on my back. I can't do Bulgarian split squat. I would love to do all that stuff. I can't. It would flare me up, so I'd be crippled again. However, there's another little piece of the puzzle, and I use that with my patients. All of these wisdoms I use in making decisions. I wouldn't use it with every patient, of course, but it's helped me. In making these decisions, one deep squat a day, sink into the bottom, preserves the squat ability, but it so spares everything else in your back. So these guys say, you got a deep squat with heavy load. Really? Let me see them when they're 60.
Well, this leads it right into the next question. We talked about butt wink in the squat, which the technical term would be posterior pelvic tilt, and there is a relationship between posterior pelvic tilt and lumbar flexion. And so when people, there are very few people who can actually achieve a rock bottom astograss squat, if you will, and keep a solid anterior pelvic tilt and lumbar extension. Most people lose their lose that arch, and people vary, with some people losing it before they even can reach parallel, and other people not. And this is very influenced by genetics and which country you came from. But we talked about this, Stu. We talked about butt wink and why some people improve upon it. And I actually filmed a video on this. I used a little Halloween skeleton I called Skelly, and I showed what we talked about. But people can improve this ability, but it is genetic. You know, there's a genetic limit. So talk about the different types of hips, Stu, and then also talk about why can you improve it over time if it's if there is some genetic, like an anatomical limit. Well, how can we improve upon it?
Okay, great question. When you do a deep squat, there are several components that determine the amount of motion at the hip. Of course, there is muscle tightness, but if you're doing a squat, that's so overridden that that's probably not going to matter much. There's the joint capsule. There's the neural tensions. And for the clientele I see, people with disc bulges and traps in their back, that matters, the neural tension that they will feel through the piriformis area and behind their hip and whatnot. But the most important rider on all of this is the depth of the hip socket. Now, if people are looking up on the internet depth of the hip socket and squatability, they won't find it. They have to go to the hip dysplasia literature. And what they'll find is there are groups in the world with very shallow hip sockets, and they have very high rates of hip dysplasia. The center of the world for hip dysplasia is Poland. They have very shallow anterior hip sockets. They can squat really, really deeply. The femur comes right up because there's no bone-on-bone contact there. It's actually called the Dalmatian hip, which originates on the Dalmatian coast of Croatia, up through Bulgaria, into Poland, and into Western Russia, which is the Ukraine. Now, I think I just named the countries that produce, year after year, unbelievable Olympic lifters. But they also have the highest rate of hip dysplasia. So, again, it's form and function, and form and function determines athletic ability. It determines where you become arthritic and all the rest of it. And it was very interesting. I occasionally do legal cases as a spine knowledge source, I guess. And I worked on a couple of murder cases, believe it or not, where they needed some spine expertise. And another one of the scientists was a professor of forensic anthropology. And it was her who first showed me all of these different hip architectures and how they change throughout the world. So it helped her to identify bodies when the skin and the hair and many features were burned off, say. Now, that's the Dalmatian hip, which is ideally suited for deep squatting. Now, you take the archetypical shallow hop socket hip, and it's a very deep hip socket, and that's the Celtic hip, prevalent in the Normandy area of France, Ireland, and Scotland. Now, how many Olympic lifters come from that country? Not in those countries, not very many. And the reason is they have very deep hip sockets. And when you measure the power production out of that hip architecture, you'll find they don't have much power in the bottom of the squat, pulling out of the hole, to use an athletic term. But the top half of the squat is really powerful. So for throwing the caber and things like that, it's a standing strength or a very shallow squat strength. That's where the power is. Now, am I saying that all Scottish people have deep hip sockets and all Poles have shallow? No, I'm not. I'm just saying that's the tendency from those genetic pools. But anyway, that's the start of the discussion. And it's not that I care where you're from, but what it motivates me to do is a hip exam. So, I mean, as you know, I have an assessment DVD where I show these techniques, and then I can start answering the questions to guide athletes. Should they be squatting deep? Should they be concerned about butt wink? Or should they avoid that because they're stressing the anterior labrum of the hip, they're stressing their spines? Chances are they're going to survive a lot much higher volume of training if they pull off blocks. So they only squat deep enough where they can save the labrum of their hip and save their spine. And, you know, say you're an NFL lineman. Why do you need to deep squat if you're an NFL lineman? Why not just squat as deep as you can to the point of where the pelvis starts to break away? Because that's where the femur is collided up against the labrum of the hip anyway. Take all the stress out. You're still going to play offensive tackle in the NFL just as well. You're still going to get strong. And better yet, you can now tolerate a higher volume of training because you're removing that stress riser. And that's a key for a lot of people.
They think, amen. Oh, yeah, man. Amen. I completely agree with you. And, I mean, really, how much difference is it going to make if the person is doing, you know, squatting to just above parallel versus squatting deep if they're already a world-class athlete? You know, but it will prolong their career. So the training must suit the individual. So answer to me the second part of that question. How do you take you will notice some people, I mean, this happens with my clients a lot. They're butt winking like crazy, and then they get better. They actually can go deeper over time and hold that position. What's happening there?
Well, it could be. Well, my answer is I don't know, but I would speculate. When you do a hip exam, and I think I did one on you, did I not? Where I scoured your thigh around an arch. Looking at the shape of the acetabulum, so we could determine optimal knee width. So, so you could squat deeper. So you know what I mean by that. So you can actually tune an athlete. And what I mean by that is if you can adjust their foot width in the setup of the squat, and as they're descending, you might want to coach, don't try and spread your knees or don't try and spread the floor, but try and open your hips, abduct your hips. You can coach them into that nice little pocket in their acetabulum where you've missed the stress riser, and you determine that from doing the hip exam. So it might be coaching. It might be...
Real quick, Stu, let me clarify that this hip exam, you can basically get people into positions, and this could be quadruped or it could be supine, but you're playing with their leg and figuring out what width elicits maximum squat depth without losing the spinal arch, and that way you can determine the proper stance width for the individual. And so this is the way they're basically, their stance width and foot flare should be that actually maximizes their squat depth, and that's going to allow them to go to the deepest without creating the most damage. And so it's different for different people. Some people do better out wider, and some people do better narrower, correct?
Exactly.
And so they are improving their motor control. You've got muscles that are working to keep them in that groove, and you also can have muscles potentially pulling and doing things to keep like say the glutes, for example, pulling rearward. That could actually help some people, you know, possibly achieve a little bit more depth just by creating maybe some space in the anterior hip socket. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's not a maybe, Brett. That's an absolute definite. That's absolutely true. So if they are descending and they can use the glutes in eccentric control, it's not in everybody, but a few people, they can now get deeper into the squat because they've de-stressed the anterior labrum, you see. They've pulled the femoral head back. And you'll find there are a few athletes who can achieve that. Not in everybody, of course.
Okay, so next question. When you are, we talked about this, and I've experienced the same thing with my EMG testing, and it's very fascinating. When you work with everyday people and you're testing EMG, what most people don't realize is they'll see something like over 100% of activation, and they don't realize, oh, how can you get over 100%? You have to normalize the data, so you have to choose either a basic position or exercise, like you could do a bodyweight squat, or an MVC position where you try to elicit a maximal contraction out of them. And then when you do the exercise that you're testing, you're comparing it to that activity. Otherwise, you just get the millivolts, which doesn't really tell you much because, for example, the glutes have fat covering it. It's not going to, you know, you're going to get lower millivolts. And so when you test MVC, when you test athletes versus average Joes, the average Joe is not very good at activating their muscles. They will get way higher when they do the exercises because they don't have good mind-muscle connections or good motor control, what have you. But athletes do way better. Is this true, Stu?
Yeah, there was two thoughts going through my mind listening to you there. One is this idea of the brain's ability to send neural signal to the muscle. We've all read documented cases where, say, a woman has seen her child under a car and is now trapped. Well documented, she went over and picked up the front of that car and someone pulled her kid out. She avulsed her hips, she crushed fractured vertebra, but somewhere she summoned the ability for her brain to send out super potentiated volleys of signals to her muscles to contract with such intensity that she picked up the car. Correct? These are well documented. So that just goes to show you that I'm fighting a head cold here. People have this ability deep down somewhere in the primal brain. The great athletes become much more clever at inhibiting the inhibitors, if you know what I mean by that. We had a good discussion, I do recall this, about inhibiting the inhibitors, and Dr. Frank came into my office, who's an expert in inhibiting the inhibitors, when we were talking about this. But athletes become clever at learning to inhibit the neural inhibitors, so they actually send stronger, denser signals to the muscle. So that was one thought that was going through my mind. But the second thought, and bodybuilders, by the way, if you measure an accomplished bodybuilder, they spend a lot of time posing in front of a mirror and simply with their brain activating muscles and getting them to stick out. So if you say to a bodybuilder, give me some serratus anterior, man, they give you terrific signals. You go to the average guy on the street and show him and coach him, here's what I need to do to get serratus anterior. They haven't a clue what you're talking about and are completely at a loss of how to activate those muscles voluntarily. So that's one very interesting feature of athletes. But the other is more just steeped in muscle contraction physiology. Most people, I hope, are in strength and conditioning anyway, are aware of the motor pool within a muscle. So there are motor neurons that stimulate the muscle to contract associated with certain fibers, and they're intertwined throughout the muscle. There are fast twitch and slow twitch, but there are all sorts of subcategories. It's not only fast twitch and slow twitch. There are certain motor units that only get activated during rapid concentric contractions. There are others that only get really activated as you're really releasing force or controlling an eccentric contraction. In other words, to really stimulate the full family within the pool, the motor pool of a muscle, you need a variety of contractions. You need slow grinding strength. Very quick, rapid strength, etc. So now we can talk about the MVC. That is an attempt by the scientist to get maximum voluntary drive to the muscle, and you do it in an isometric contraction. In the great athletes, you get them to mentally focus on it, and as you cue them, etc. But say you were doing a leg muscle, then you simply got the person to walk or run, and even just a fast, a mediocre pace of running will recruit a whole new membership in that motor pool that you could never get even in a maximum contraction. I sent you some EMG traces today of you, which were normalized, but they are not still telling the truth. What the model does is kind of interesting. It takes the EMG signals, which were collected and normalized to an isometric maximum contraction. But as you move, whether the muscle is shortening or lengthening, we take all that into account. Instantaneous muscle length is also taken into account, because all of these are modulators of that relationship of the muscle converting the electrical signal through to a muscle force. So we still have a lot of work to do on your data that we collected, although I sent you the raw signals today, and we could say, okay, well, one muscle is on more than the other, which is true from the sense of neural drive. But the question was, were they producing more force or not? We can't answer yet until we get into the actual joint position of the muscle activity at that instant in time, and whether it was modulated by shortening or lengthening and instantaneous length and all these other modulators of that relationship. But I probably spoke way too much on that, but does that?
Yep, that and it's something that kind of ties into this attentional focus, external versus internal. Have you had a lot of success in your career using an internal attentional focus, for example, with fixing movement patterns or getting people to direct more neural drive to a muscle, and then eventually that reaches automaticity? That's the whole goal. You want them to eventually not have to think about using their glutes or when they do something. But initially, I'll just say, in my opinion, our industry goes too far with most things. Something new comes out and it becomes this all or nothing approach. Yes, if I'm have an athlete who's trying to set a broad jump, you know, I'm testing their broad jump, I'm not going to say, I want you to maximally contract your quadriceps before takeoff or something stupid like that. Obviously, I'm going to give an external attentional focus and say, I want you to jump as far as possible. See this line here? I want you to clear this, or I want you to whatever. It's going to be directing their attention towards the external environment, and that's going to lead to better performance. But in my opinion, a lot of the role of the strength coach or the physical therapist is not to maximize performance. It's to maximize form and prevent them from injury. I mean, you see these CrossFit highlight, nothing against CrossFit, but some of the CrossFit highlight videos that are just ridiculous. That's what you get when you have a purely external attentional focus on setting records rather than using good form. And so I personally have had a lot of success with giving people internal cues, knees out, chest up, squeeze the glutes, you know, things like that. And then, you know, over time, they reach automaticity and you can shift more towards external focus. But you use it sparingly. When you want them to set a record, external. When you're working on form, internal. Do you agree with my approach?
I'm going to say yes. How's that?
Yes.
Yeah. I am. But, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head in the lead up to that. And that is when people take a position that's dogmatic. They're following dogma. Always do this. External is better than internal. These are ridiculous arguments. There's a time and a place for all of these. And I said my answer was yes, because I agree with, generally speaking, when you're coaching good movement, you begin with the internal cues and you shift to external cues when the person is competent. And I'm just repeating what you're saying. So, you know, no great person follows dogma. They make decisions. They're not a computer running an algorithm that's based on a dogma. They are thinking people who are well-educated and know their material. They know the person that they're working with, and they pull out the best tool to achieve the goal at that point in time. And as the person changes, they will have to change tools. There's no room for dogma.
And that's why it's so important to have a large arsenal over time, because you never know when you're going to use this tool or this tool. And they come up with different people. You mentioned you're a case study guy. I loved that, because you are given, you know, you're handed over an athlete, a $1 million athlete, and you're charged to try to help their back pain. It's a different situation for every person. It's
depending on their... Would you go for a $50 million athlete?
Good point. But it's dependent upon their anatomy, their movement patterns, their sport, their goal, their age, everything, you know. Then that leads us into another question. The universal answer to everything is it depends. Can you comment on that?
Well, people ask me, what's my position on an issue, or what am I going to do with it? You know, you have this person, or what's the best exercise, or any of these questions. The answer is always, it depends. Now, tell me about the things that I would need to know to make the best decision. So, yeah, I don't have a position on anything. All I have is a knowledge base that I have some confidence in, and I also have confidence in what I don't know, and I try and seek the best solution. But if you put two people in front of me with, for the most part, you know, a certain category of back pain, but I might choose a different tool for each person because one has longer legs, for example. So there you go. The answer always is it depends. And in fact, I teach that introductory course that I was describing earlier. I would pose a question on the board, and I'd point to a student and say, "What's the answer to that?" And then they got it. They said, "It depends." I said, "Good for you." And then I posed another question, and I asked the next student, "What's the answer to that?" And they said, "It depends." So they that was the lesson for today.
Another quote that I really like from my supervisor, John Cronin. The first thing he said to me when I started studying under him is, "You know, Brett, I always say this, this is how I feel today. And tomorrow, as I learn more, my opinion is subject to change." He flows with the research. And I think that's, we talked about the mindset of an evidence-based person. You flow. You are not set in stone. You are not black and white. There's gray area, and sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we have to change our mind. But as long as you use an evidence-based approach, which does not mean ignoring anecdotes, it means trying to use all the tools available and weighing those, you know, the evidence and looking at research, looking at experiments, looking at logic, taking logic into consideration, looking at anecdotes and trying to make the most sense of all the different scientific tools out there. And I think that's one thing, Stu, for example, with what we just did at your labs, I don't know how the chips are going to fall, but I'm interested to see it. And I'm open-minded to learning stuff that I was wrong about certain predictions. It's kind of funny. You and I both felt confident in our MVC position for the gluteus maximus to the people still listening now at an hour and 50 minutes in. I said, you know, Stu, it's going to be the quadruped hip extension, bent legs with no external resistance. So I'm going to get on all fours, bend my knee, kick my leg back, squeeze my glute as hard as possible, and that's going to elicit a maximal contraction in the gluteus maximus, whereas Stu had me straighten my leg, get still in the quadruped position on all fours, had me straighten my leg, kick rearward, kind of focusing on extending my leg as far as possible, and then he extending outward, not upward, and then he pushed downward on my leg and offered resisted hip extension. And it's funny because we were both very confident. In fact, we bet the loser has to buy the other a beer the next time we see each other. And as it turns out, we were both right. Stu's MVC position elicited more EMG in the upper glutes, whereas mine worked more in the mid glutes or the mid lower glutes. And so I learned. That's a learning experience. But you categorize it. You keep it in check. You say, okay, that's how it worked with me. I'd like to see how it works with 10 other people, you know? And I think that's so important for the practitioner to have that type of mindset, but it has to be developed. You just like you get better as an athlete, you get better as a lifter, you get better as a scientist as well. You agree with all this, Stu?
Yes.
So anyway, let's move on a couple more questions and then I will let you get going. But talk about your thoughts on breathing training. So a popular trend in the industry right now is this diaphragmatic breathing. I have not done a ton of research on this, but I think a lot of people, they either are like upper chest breathers and they have dysfunctional breathing patterns. And some coaches and therapists have found that if they get people down and work on their breathing, they can take them out of, sympathetic, maybe they're relying more on the sympathetic division of their autonomic nervous system and activating that through their breathing. And when they get them to calm down and breathe through the diaphragm and, you know, let their abdominal cavity rise first and then the chest, you will turn more to a parasympathetic state. You will relax. It'll, you're not mimicking this fight or flight response. You're going to possibly decrease cortisol and things like that. I could be getting some of this wrong. That's just my impression through reading some blogs. I have not done a ton of it in my practice just because I don't see a lot of research. I'm waiting for research. And I will add, there's nothing wrong with waiting till research emerges if you don't know the answer to something or you aren't confident about it. But I surmise that I wouldn't want to do this with athletes before a workout because you're actually trying to get them to prime their nervous system. You want them to be warm and primed for the workout. You don't want them to be in a relaxed parasympathetic state. But I could be wrong. I think most of my colleagues would say to that, well, they're in a sympathetic state round the clock. You want to get them out of that so their muscles can fire properly or something. To which case I'd say, fine, let's do that at the end of the workout. But again, I don't know much about this. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I like you, I don't have any experience at all in, I've certainly seen people put on workshops for breathing at these very low levels of demand. I don't know what to make of it. So I'm like you on that. I don't have the expertise, but I've done certainly analyses of breathing in challenge situations, and I can comment on that if you want to hear it.
Yep, sure.
Okay. Well, when we are doing what we call stabilization training, making a stiff core, we try and breathe freely. Don't entrain the breathing, and then perform the exertion. So for most of that initial stabilization training, we breathe freely. However, when we start adding load and speed, our breathing instructions and exercises changes dramatically. And I'm just going to tell a quick story. I was in a hotel one time just watching the tennis on the TV, and the Venus Williams was on, and the announcers were saying, there goes Venus, really intimidating her opposition today because she would, yell. It's called the guttural effusion when she served the tennis ball. And I thought, those guys, that may be sensational, but that's not why she does it at all. That whole idea of guttural effusion adds stiffness to the core. It's active expiration. We've measured this in spades. It turns on the oblique muscles. It super drives them in that instant of you filled the lungs with air, and then that first little expulsion is driven by the abdominal muscles. That adds even more stiffness. Now, when she's serving the tennis ball, let's just take the example of the pec major muscle. The pec major goes from the rib cage across the shoulder joints to the humerus. If we shorten and contract the humerus, the arm flexes around and moves, but the rib cage also bends towards the shoulder joint. So that's an energy leak. That doesn't help swing the arm around. It causes the rib cage to bend. However, if you can fixate and stiffen the proximal end of the muscle, the pec, 100% of the pec activity is expressed on the distal side of the shoulder. In other words, it brings the arm around at a higher velocity because 100% of the velocity is on the arm. It's not the rib cage is being prevented from moving. So now we're getting into real stabilization mechanics. The more we can stiffen and prevent movement in the core during rapid, explosive shoulder and hip movements, it means the legs and the arms move faster. So when she super drives that stiffening mechanism through the just as she's letting air out, we've measured this, that creates a super stiffness in her core and higher arm velocity. She puts a few more miles an hour on her serve. So that is a form of power breathing, and it's this form of super stiffness that she's able to create in the core, as many athletes do. When you get into carrying heavy load, whether you're doing a farmer's carry, a suitcase walk, a deadlift, we can then get into where you fill the lungs to about 70 or 80% of full tide, and then you lock it down. You make it very stiff. And then you can use your hips to lever the stiff crane and pull the load, lift the load, creating a very rigid derrick through your upper body, and the hips then become the prime movers of that lift. And when you measure the great lifters, and I have, that's the mechanics of what they're doing. And breathing, or not breathing, shall we say, is very, very important. Then what they do is they sip the air. So if you look at an Olympic lifter, for example, on a clean and jerk, they perform the clean. If they let the air out of their lungs and breathe, chances are their spine would collapse. They're that close to breaking mechanism. But they'll sip the air. They'll be at they're holding the bar in the clean, and they if the listenership gets what it is I was just doing, a very small volume sipping the air, and then they time that last sip with the explosive thrust through a stiff core, driving the bar upwards for the jerk part of the lift. Now, having said all of that, we then get into the martial arts and the fighting skills, and we could start that off with a kettlebell swing, where the kettlebell is swung, and as it comes through top dead center at the top of the swing, the spine actually undergoes an odd combination of compression and shear. And there's some people where they don't like that. It tweaks their back a little bit. Other people will say, no, it's very therapeutic for my back. But if you watch someone like Pavel Satsulin, who's an absolute, he really is a master with a lot of these kettlebell techniques and in lifting. He's a superb lifter. He power breathes. So he swings the bell up, and if you know what I mean, it's a very...
hisses almost.
It is. And what that does is, and once again, it's another form of super stiffening his core, which does several things. It accentuates the hip drive on one hand, but if you can then learn that power breathing and apply it to a combative match where you're striking with leg strikes and hand strikes, you'll hear the fighters do the same hiss and guttural effusions, which is super stiffening the core, and then they release the air as the arm is increasing velocity as the fist is increasing closing velocity to the target. And then once again, when the fist strikes the opponent, their body becomes super stiff again. So they're not hitting the person with the weight of their foot or their fist. They're actually got their whole body in a stone-like fashion behind the fist, which is called creating effective mass. So if you're a 172-pound welterweight in the UFC, you're hitting your opponent with 172 pounds of that stiffened fist. So I've measured all of these things. Certainly not the corrective breathing as you were describing it, diaphragmatic breathing. I don't know anything about that. But I know a little bit about supercharging performance with appropriate breathing, and I've given you four or five different examples that were all slightly different.
Well, just some things you touched on. I remember reading in Zatziorski's The Science and Practice of Strength Training, where he recommends holding 70 to 85% of tidal volume. That's the sweet spot for optimizing performance. It was good to hear you use the same percentages. And then when you talked about Pavel, he and I have had some interesting conversations through email. I've never met him in person. I hope to eventually. But I have a ton of respect for him and his attention to detail with exercises, even the plank and things like that, the things he can do with that. I never thought of a plank before I started reading his stuff and realizing all the different things you could do to kind of create increased joint moments just through using the floor as resistance. And anyway, let's move on to next topic. We talked briefly about head and neck position during deadlifts, and you mentioned that you feel that it's optimal to kind of look up. And I told you that it's a kind of controversy in our field that we should be packing the neck. Now, I did research on this topic, and I found that you're never neutral. You're never the strongest in neutral, and you're not delivering the most neural drive. Now, the research is limited. We don't have research on deadlifts, but there is research on gripping and like isometric curls and things like that. But when you do a grip, you get the strongest strength, the strongest MVC torque when your head is turned the opposite way of the hand that's gripping, and when doing a curl is looking up. But I have studied a lot of the strongest lifters, and I think it's very individual. Some guys look down, some guys look up. What are your thoughts on are there reflexes that could be initiated? I know that I believe Mel Siff might have written something about looking up creates an extensor reflex with the posterior chain muscles. I've never seen that in the research, though. But do you have any opinions on head and neck position with different exercises?
Yeah, I do, Brett. I wish you could see me because I'm just laughing to myself here. You know, we just met, and I had heard things about you because people would come up to me and say, you know, what do you think about Contreras? Because he said this, either supporting something you said or against it. And you know, I really didn't know what to think. But what is uncanny in this was that your little explanation there was just exactly the way I would have thought. I've heard these dogmatic, once again, positions on the best neck position for lifting. I've measured the neck position in some elite performers, and you hit the nail on the head. They're all different. And we get back to that it depends answer. And so as soon as you believe in a dogma that it's always one way or another, you will help a few people, you will be good with them, but you won't be so good with some others. And the trick of it all, the magic happens when you realize there's different mechanisms and there's a lot of variables. And I'm not so sure what those variables are. I suspect that in lifting, the lifting musculature starts with the trapezius hanging from the neck. So you'll see some big necks, and then you'll see some people who have very long necks, and you'll see others who have very short necks. How they position their neck and the style of the pull and how the architecture of Trapezius all hangs from their neck. It really is going to depend on their own personal architecture. So that's my first reaction to that. But the second one is, and we don't really talk too much about our current work in progress, but I'm working with one of my colleagues in Europe right now. As we speak, he's measuring nerve conduction velocity and muscle performance in the back extensors, as a function of different head positions. Now, what those head positions do is put a pre-stress on the neural tract. When you tension a nerve, it thins out, it necks down and thins out, which changes its nerve propagation velocity and ability to conduct volume. You follow what I mean with that?
No, is that when you put it on stretch or
exactly. When you put a nerve on stretch, it changes its ability to carry the amount of signal and the speed at which it carries it at. I don't know where it's, but he's shown me some of the preliminary data, and I can tell you that we're going to have a really interesting story to tell, because the head position determines the performance out of your back muscles. So it isn't always one, and it's not always the other. There are some variables that the true expert will come to understand. And that's why we all see a variety. Look, if you're Andy Bolton and you're lifting, you got to figure that Andy's figured out his neck position for him pretty well.
Yep, exactly. Right?
You know, he's a very, very methodical guy. He has tweaked and tuned every tiny little element, and that's why he's so good at what he does. But is his neck position the same as another person who has a different architecture? And the answer is, of course not. It's different.
Well, that's interesting. And is this research that you're doing overseas, is it with stoop lifting or deadlifting, or is it with different things? Because there's been no research on this. This will be the first research that I've seen.
Yeah, I'm not going to give away too much more at this time, if you don't mind, Brett.
Nope, don't mind at all. I understand. But what you mentioned, that's what's so nice when you actually, because it's so easy to just make theories. But when you actually work in a laboratory with EMG, force plate, all these, you know, you've got a lot more than I would love to have your lab. Maybe you can leave it to me in your will.
You can arrange for my demise.
I know. You better be careful about that. But when you measure the different variables, you see, you know, with EMG, you see such, you know, yeah, the average, you know, research tends to report averages. I like how in a couple of your papers, Stu, you'll break out and kind of say, this person did this. Like, that's one thing I love about your research. You'll talk about, well, this strong man did this. Or Pavel, when he was swinging the kettlebell, did this. He was able to activate this. I don't see that very often. Usually all you see is the averages, and that doesn't tell the whole story, because 2 of the 10 people might do better with this technique, but the average shows differently. And so that's, again, what we're talking about, the power of the case study. At the end of the day, you've got to find out what works best for the individual.
You know, again, you've hit the nail on the head. If I can just make a brief comment on that, because I do tend to turn heads every now and then when I hear people criticizing a study because it didn't find statistical significance. On average, there was no difference. And yet, they'll leave the paper and they'll walk away. You and I don't do that. We will then go into the data, and then we find, lo and behold, 40% of the people had a positive effect to the intervention, 40% had a negative effect to the intervention, and the remaining 20%, it made no diddly damn bit of difference. But 40% of those people were affected positively. What were the features of those people that it affected? And now we're really getting into the nitty-gritty. So that's a very key point. I love studies that, on average, are statistically insignificant. I want to know about the outliers.
Amen. Okay, I know I said this, but a couple more things, then we'll be done. in the world of pain research, there, and I, at one point I was purely all biomechanics and pain. Someone's hurting, there's a biomechanical reason for that, I need to fix it. And then I got exposed to these very bright individuals who study pain, who look at and got exposed to the biopsychosocial model, and learned about things like the neuromatrix. And the neuromatrix was fascinating to me because, you know, talking about phantom limbs and how these people are still experiencing pain even though their limb has been amputated. It's your brain has a mental map, a neural matrix, if you will. It's your brain's depiction of the body, but it's not the actual body. And these things are all important to know about pain. However, when I help people, when I try to fix people, again, I'm not a physical therapist, but hell, everyone, you take the average client, and, you know, they have some aches and pains and things that don't feel so good. And they also can, you know, when you start getting them stronger, things arise. And I always take a biomechanical approach to that. I don't say to them, okay, you're depressed, I'm going to try to cheer you up. Or, okay, I'm going to use I always use a biomechanical approach, and I know that's been the crux of your career. I guess my question is, do you keep this stuff in the back of your mind when you work with people and kind of realize, like, you know, if you look at the research, there is not a lot of research showing that anterior pelvic tilt increases the incidence of back pain, or that, people's biomechanics really, on average, on the whole, it does not lead to pain. But when you work with people and you, like what you said, you provoke their pain, usually you can find things that hurt it. So then you get them to avoid that, and you get them to, you know, move in a way that's not painful, and then you gradually increase their fitness on and build upon those patterns. The biomechanist would say you are improving, you are decreasing their mechanical insults, you are, you know, improving their function, their biomechanics, and decreasing pain, whereas the pain scientist or the biopsychosocial model might explain it differently. They might say you have these, you know, these neuro tags, and you're having these threat responses, and through doing the new movement, you are decreasing that threat response. You're teaching the body to move in a different way and accept it. And they're working with a high level coach or trainer, or, you know, in your case, world's leading spinal biomechanist. They are comfortable, they're confident, and so that's going to really affect the results of their recovery, because they're so confident with you and they're expecting a result. So it's kind of like the placebo effect in a way. But is it important to know both sides, or are you a pure biomechanics guy? Talk about that a little bit.
I don't think I'm a pure anything. It's important, absolutely, to be as knowledgeable as you possibly can to explore alternate possibilities, alternate explanations for what you're observing. I could give you case after case after case where traditional pure biomechanical thought couldn't give an explanation for what you're seeing in front of you in a patient or an athlete. But having said that, let me just take the other side, and then I'll come back to this. There are those who say, oh, for pain, we're going to teach them to live with their pain, to handle their pain. We're going to tell them the pain is mostly in their head. It's a perception, and we're going to modulate their brain to handle their pain. This is where I really start to disagree. If you can do provocative testing and cause their pain to get worse by putting them in an awkward posture or stressing the painful site somehow, and if they say, oh yeah, that hurts more, you've just proven that it's a mechanical variable that makes their pain worse. And probably, if you can take that away, that mechanical insult away, the pain will be less and hopefully even disappear. So I don't believe in and this is a rather harsh opinion, but those who are real proponents, it's all this psychosocial, they are very poor with their mechanical of understanding, their mechanical understanding of the phenomenon. So it becomes a default diagnosis. By default, we can't find the pain in you. Our interventions don't work on you. It's not that we're bad doctors. It's that you're a bad patient. The pain is in your head. So it's a default diagnosis, and therefore the patient should have psychological counseling. That's what I really get annoyed with, because we've had patient after patient who've had these diagnoses, and we find sometimes it's very simple and obvious that they, it's just that they've never been tested for the mechanical cause of their pain. I had a patient yesterday. I phoned her and asked her, how are you doing? And I couldn't figure out her pain. It didn't make mechanical sense. And yet she said, I had surgery. They found that two nerve roots from two adjacent levels were coming through the same foramen. I had an anatomic anomaly. I'm going to be in the medical literature because I had a freak. I'm a freak with the anatomy of my nerves. And then I said, aha, well, that so explains how you are having both femoral and sciatic nerve symptoms. So, you know, again, it's just when you keep the detective work going, you can usually find it. There's cases of fibromyalgia that I'll see occasionally where the person has, as you said, a changed neural matrix. What is movement to some person, their brain has now perceived as pain. And to change their neural matrix, the way we would attempt it, and admittedly, we're not very successful with it, but occasionally we are on the very tough cases who failed all other approaches, including the psychosocial approaches. You teach the body to move pain-free. Do what it can do pain-free, and then slowly increase the repertoire of pain-free movement as the brain learns how to perceive those movements. But anyway, there are a few discussions skirting around that issue of the whole psychosocial. But, you know, there's no question. Mechanical things, injury, tissue stress causes pain. How the person reacts to that, it depends. If you've got a spouse at home that's yelling at you and stressing you out, chances are you will become more sensitized to that pain. If you hate your job and you really don't want to go back to work, that's a social issue, and you will probably magnify that pain, etc.
I think they would say it causes deformation, it causes tissue damage, but the brain is what decides whether to elicit that pain response. But what I always wonder with these, with some types. Now, I interviewed a guy named Jason Silvernail. I can't tell you how much respect I have for him. He's a CSCS. He's taken he cares about both sides of both worlds. But when I get someone who just tells me that, you know, there's no association with biomechanics and pain, I want to say to them, let me have you do three sets of round back deadlifts to failure, see how you feel the next day. I bet you if I did that to 100 people, all 100 of them would hurt. And I'm talking full lumbar flexion under heavy, heavy load. I could probably, you know, herniate some discs or snap some ligaments right then and there if I really loaded them up as heavy as possible. So I just wonder, you know, I would hate to be, like, I try to be cautious in my conclusions, but sometimes I wonder if they're not trying to meet in the middle and learn our side of the equation. And, you know, because Stu, you've worked with people with some of the most jacked up spines, and, you know, that. They're going to be, and I've seen the literature, half, like 50% of people have herniated discs, and a lot of them are, you know, pain-free, asymptomatic. But the point is, when you work with a person, usually you can get them out of their pain by figuring out, by incorporating biomechanics, and whether that's working through this, you know, through the, you're working through the brain, you're working through, obviously, you're working through the, you know, this psychological, sociological, biological model, but it's all related, and that's what those guys would admit. Hey, the biopsychosocial model, the bio portion of it is biomechanical, of course. I just think we kind of, since we deal with athletes, we tend to possibly look more at the mathematics, the physics, but it's very, very critical because I've heard of stories where people were kind of given a nocebo effect by being told that this movement causes pain. Squats are bad for your back, deadlifts are bad for your back, or this is bad for your back, and this posture is bad for your back, or you have anterior pelvic tilt, you're going to have back pain. It's very important to understand the limitations of the biomechanical model and to understand the biopsychosocial model, but to keep them all in their place. That's just my two cents, at least.
Yeah, okay. That's I'm not going to add any more to that.
Okay, two more questions. So the last question is going to be about your mustache, but this next question is probably this question is going to be probably what my listeners and a lot of people in the industry want to hear us talk about. I wrote a blog post a few years back, talking about how I like back extensions and reverse hypers. At that time, now see, you have to put into context, I purchased a glute ham developer and a 45-degree back raise off of and a reverse hyper from Elite FTS like, I don't know, 10 years ago. And so I used this equipment with my clients. And I don't train 20 athletes at once. You know, I would train people out of my garage, and then I opened up a gym, and I would train a few people once. I did small group training, but I could watch their form. I could teach them how to move at the hips. To me, a back extension is really a hip extension. You are teaching them how to, you know, stiffen their spine and erect their torso with their glutes and hamstrings, pull their body up using the glutes and hamstrings while keeping the spine stabilized. That's just hip extension to me. I didn't even like glute ham raises that much. I use them for pure back extensions most, like 9 times out of 10. I just love the exercise, and it's very well tolerated as long as you're doing it that way. I would say the reverse hyper is harder to control spinal motion because it's so dynamic, but there is a way to perform reverse hypers where when the pendulum is swinging down, you don't let the belt swing you into full flexion the way that Louis Simmons does it. You actually stop it yourself using, you know, the eccentric nature of the hamstrings and the glutes. You stop it. You don't let your low back move into flexion. And then as you reverse the weight and raise it into full hip extension, you are squeezing the glutes to prevent that excessive lumbar hyperextension. But it's easier with the back extension, the 45-degree hyper. But so we'll talk about that and then crunches after this. Can these lifts be performed in a safer versus – so there's a way you typically see them performed, and there's a safer way to perform them. Can you categorically say that back extensions are bad for everyone, or that will they be good for certain people, or is it – can you paint a broad, you know, stroke and say no one should be doing these exercises? What do you think about that?
It depends.
Yes, there you go.
Okay. I mean, you know, look, you were talking earlier about Professor Z, Vladimir Zatsiorsky. You know, he was there in the great era of Soviet dominance in the 70s and the 80s. They had athletes like Vasily Alexeyev and personalities like this. I mean, I don't know anyone who set more Olympic and international records. It's certainly in heavyweight Olympic lifting, there's no one that would compare with the number of records that he set. And yet, if you can talk to Professor Z, because he was there at the Moscow Institute of Physical Culture, the Russian Institute, what do you think Alexeyev's favorite exercise was?
Actually, well, I think I remember reading about that. He loved his back extensions.
Of course he did. Of course he did, with a heavy weight, either clutched to the chest or on his back. So are you going to argue with that? You know, in terms of proof of the pudding, you or I or no one else can argue. But realize that he was one in a billion. These great athletes are mutants. We can look at some and look at their training volume and what they tolerate. But there was something very special about his back that allowed him to tolerate. Would it be good for me? No, it would break me in two.
But, was he doing hip extension or back, you know, spinal extension? I guess that's what you'd need to know.
Well, I didn't see it, so there's a good question for Professor Z. But let's go back to the glute ham raise, because I know, again, I've been so interpreted and misquoted on that one.
Now, I don't want to talk about the glute ham raise where you're doing knee flexion to raise your body up. I'm talking about a horizontal back. It's called a back extension, but it's really folding in half at the hips and then raising
up. Simmons's glute ham raise is what you're
saying. No, he does the reverse hyper where the torso is laying across. That's a reverse hyper. The torso is laid across the unit. The legs are free to move, whereas in the glute ham developer.
Hold on, just let me comment on that one, because that's a small little study in my book, Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance. There's a picture of Art McDermott, one of the great strongman personalities of a few years ago, and I'm showing him he's rested his belly and chest over the glute ham machine doing the reverse hypers the way you're describing. But then I prop up on his elbows where he stiffens his whole spine to really isolate the hip motion. So it really is in hip extension. Then it becomes a really nice device. But again, you know, there are some people and they don't mind that little bit of spine motion. There are other people that it just is such an exacerbator of
the
problem.
Who are extension intolerant, who might have aggravation with the posterior elements of the spine.
Well, it could be someone who's flexion intolerant, extension intolerant, or just plain motion intolerant down at the lumbosacral joint. There's all three categories would be irritated if they didn't fixate that junction to allow the fixated pelvis and really focus the motion at the hip.
But if you have a talented coach that and you take – think about how much time and effort we put into teaching squats and deadlifts in these exercises. And if you put that same sort of attention and you develop a very good system with teaching certain exercises, they can be done in ways that are much more tolerable. And again, there are a lot of people who do the reverse hyper and they feel irritation. It's neural tension related, and it just irritates them. They feel tingly and weird and numb, and it just feels off. But with back extensions off the glute ham developer or like the 45-degree back raise, that's easier to do where you can kind of make it more pure hip extension. Now, I would guess that you are getting lots of shear forces when you do these on the spine. However, as we talked about earlier, maybe you can build up a tolerance to shear, or if your spine is in neutral, I don't know. How do you explain? Yeah, you know, because even pushing sleds would induce a lot of shear. Kettlebell swings induce a lot of shear. But people, nevertheless, when we train them up to be these beasts, they can tolerate it. So how is that explainable?
Boy, there's a lot of variables that you're touching on now. The spine's ability to bear shear is a function of its curvature. The ligaments have huge cosines to them. So if you bend the spine to a position where the ligaments become taut and involved, they create quite a shear force. The muscles themselves have a restorative shear cosine. So if you are doing a spine extension, the low back has a shear cosine to the erector spinae that supports that shear. So the forces of, say, a driving force on a sled, you have to be careful with some of those assumptions. So sometimes you can balance the shears right up.
Yeah, I think I remember in your article on rowing, I think it was bent over rows or something, where I expected these huge shear loads and I didn't see that, and that's because the muscles are balancing out the loads. Correct?
Because there's a reaction shear. Gravity is working on the load plus your rib cage, and it's pulling your rib cage forward on your pelvis, creating an anterior shear. But the muscles are creating a posterior shear and balancing that to a very tolerable level. But here's the rub. The direction, the cosine of those muscles and the ability to balance shear is a function of their spine curvature. So this is yet another consideration. If someone rounds their back or flexes their spine a little bit, on some people, it really changes the muscle's ability to buttress and neutralize the shear. Now, you mentioned the different people's reactions. I'm not going to mention specific names here, but there are some very strong personalities. I mean, not personalities, but personalities with extremely strong bodies. And your listenership will, if I said their names, they would know who they are. And when you work with them, you find, they have a very very specific training regimen, but they've tuned it for them. But if we're up at our cottage and I take them out kayaking, they can't tolerate kayaking. Well, give me a break. I mean, you can pick up that, and you can throw this, and you can fight this person, and yet when we go for a kayak together, your back is screaming. Or I might take someone else. You might find this interesting. We did a study on the elliptical trainers, and we wondered why some people say, oh, I like this elliptical. It really makes my back feel okay. And then you'll take another person, quite a robust athlete, and they get on the elliptical and say, oh, man, this tweaks my back. And it was so interesting. I did this with Jan Morside, one of my PhD.
Yeah, I read that study.
We screened a couple hundred students, and then she trained the tightest hips and the loosest hips, so to speak. But in any case, guess which ones, which hips really enjoyed the elliptical? It was the loose hips. Well, of the dozen people she trained with the tight hips, surprise, surprise, 9 out of the 12 were hockey players. She didn't screen for hockey players. That was what was selected in the tight-hipped group. And that group got bad backs when they used the elliptical. So again, it's just I hope there's been a common theme a little bit today in this answer. It depends, and we have to look at individual differences. You can't follow dogma on this. There's just so many variables to consider.
And moving in, that moves us right into, again, what my readers would want to hear, because when Brad Schoenfeld and I published our article on crunches, we were, it's funny, I still remember talking to Brad and saying, I think Stu's going to like our conclusions here. Now, we were very hardcore in scrutinizing, in our scrutiny. However, with our conclusions, if you read, and I did not like the industry's reaction, because it was like, I think most people, most of the experts just glanced at it, and they were saying don't ever do a crunch. And so if I'm saying it's okay to crunch, then they're thinking, oh my God, he's going against us and he's going against Stu McGill. Let's feed him to the wolves. And it annoyed me, because I don't even think some of the coaches read the article or even capable of, reading an article properly. But if you look at our whole conclusions are do like, control the tempo. First of all, the most important thing was just go to 30 degrees of total trunk flexion. And most of that range of motion would be taken up in the thoracic spine. And then we talked about posture. We talked about volume and load. And we said, look, if you kind of control the tempo and squeeze the top, you're not, the people I work with, they can't then do 100 crunches that way. They get to 20 or 25, but some get to 15 and they're shaking like hyenas. So we said do it at a slow tempo and kind of hold the isometric, and then limit it to like 50 cycles, 40 cycles or something like that, three times a week. And to me, that's so much better than what most people out there are doing, 500 crunches. We're not saying go crunch away in full lumbar flexion. We are saying watch your lumbar spine. And this is a lot of this is due to, I think, a very important study by Michael Adams, a prominent spinal researcher. I think it was in 1985 he had a study where he showed that the bending stress, if you took a disc, say a motion segment, say it went to 13 total degrees of motion, but you just went to 11 degrees instead of 13, then you reduce the stress on that disc by 50%. So that just goes to show you how important it is to avoid full lumbar flexion and how dangerous those, I would imagine maybe like an exponential curve with that stress on the disc. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I would just say it's if you're only going to 4 degrees range of motion per motion segment, you're going to greatly reduce the injury potential there. The nucleus will not be working its way through the I don't even know how to say this. I've read it a million times. The lamella or lamella. That was just my take on it, and I felt like I gave safe recommendations, and it was a good compromise because you have the McGill crunch, where you just kind of raise up and kind of keep the spine in neutral. Brad and I are just saying go a little higher, but we're both saying avoid the range of motion in the lumbar spine. Comment on that and don't be afraid. Don't pull any punches if you totally disagree. But what do you think about my recommendations there?
It depends. So, a few of the things you said I would completely agree with and partially disagree with others. So this idea of, you can do a partial curl up because you're avoiding lumbar flexion, but you're going to have thoracic flexion. That's okay. But what happens when you have a person who sits at a computer for 8 hours a day and they're slouched over the computer? This idea that you create cumulative trauma in the training session, and that's where you're going to measure what the total exposure in the work week, that doesn't fit anymore. This person sits watching the television. They sit up, propped up in bed, reading a book. This excuse me, this modern lifestyle. When you do some provocative testing and try and understand their pain a little bit, they'll be showing you, no, I get pain up in my mid-back. And I hope we would both agree that for that particular person, you probably don't want to do thoracic extension because it's hurting them as well. So this idea of cumulative trauma, it's accumulating all day long. What's interesting is, and people who work out, find this so unfair that they train an hour every day and yet they sit at work for 20 minutes and their back gets sore. And then there's the couch potato who sits in the booth beside them at work, never does any training. They eat awful things and yet they never have back pain and they think it's so unfair. But this is what happens. That couch potato has never started the cumulative trauma or the delamination of the laminae, as you're describing, the collagen fibers of the disc. They've never started that traumatic process. Whereas the person who trains an hour a day, they may have started it through doing deadlifts and power cleans and things with poor form, and it's pretty easy to do with high load and poor form. And then when they sit at work, that little bit of extra bending stress suddenly becomes painful. But it's only painful because they had that pre-existing trauma from the way they chose to train. So I'm in a little bit of a spot here. We're trying to make general recommendations for the general populace, finding the balance between training and becoming fitter and stronger and all of those good things with not allowing the pace of laminar delamination to run ahead of that repair process. So it's difficult. That's really difficult in this modern lifestyle. Our grandparents didn't have to deal with this. They were, you know, walking behind the horse plow and all these things. Even our parents as plumbers and electricians didn't have to deal with it. And I'm not saying modern plumbers now don't have back pain because they do. But my point in all of that is why take the risk? Now, why are you training? If you're training because you're an athlete and you have to reach a certain level of physical proficiency to perform, all right, you've got to choose the tools to do that in a wise way. But the purpose of your training is to enhance your performance. If you're me, all I want to do is have no pain, be reasonably fit, and when I put on courses and seminars, I have the physical abilities to do good demonstrations and have some content validity in what I'm doing. That's what I need. But that's all I need. And if I do any more, I risk getting sore. And I will get sore and I'll get hurt. So folks have to find the reasons why they're training and then choose the best tools. And it's a risk reward all the time. So I would say that if you're the average person and you're just training to be healthy, get to 80 years old and still have your joints intact, then do the McGill crunch. You'll probably be better off. Do a few push-ups. There's a great abdominal trainer. Maybe do a few stir the pots, all these kinds of things. I really wouldn't do curl-ups. Then when we look at the military studies where they tested soldiers who have to pass the speed sit-up test every year, they took a group where they didn't even train speed sit-ups. They took it right out of the program, but they replaced it with planks and stir the pot and these kind of exercises, which were much easier on their joints. Lo and behold, when they came to test them on the speed sit-up scores, they did better, and they never trained it. So they were still able to train hip flexion and torso moment. And people get confused of the difference between flexion motion, which is the kinematic variable, and flexion torque, which is the moment or the effort, shall we say. And the key is really to keep...
For example, to clarify that, you can do ab wheel rollout or from the knees or something like that, keeping the spine in neutral, you're creating a huge... The abdominals have to contract very hard to prevent spinal extension, so they have to create a huge internal flexion moment, but you don't have the motion there as long as you keep your spine stable. So you're saying train the moment, train the moment, but don't train the motion.
Right. That's a wiser thing. So now let's do some case studies here. Let's take a few UFC fighters who have to train jiu-jitsu, which is you have to have a very flexible spine. You have to move it into flexion, and you have to have the ability to have high flexion torque as well. Now, they're 26 years of age. They've worn out their back. They're in so much back pain that they can't tolerate training. They will not make the next UFC gig, their big payday. So what are we going to do? What we'll do is we will take out the pain trigger, which is the motion, not the torque, the motion. And we'll replace their 1,000 sit-ups, 1,000 partial curl-ups that they do, because that has stolen their ability to train. They've got no volume capability at all left. We're going to take that out. We're going to have them do stir the pot and push-ups and roll-outs and all of these kinds of things. Well, interestingly enough, you'll find that their strike speed quite often increases because of that idea of the stiff core unleashing the athleticism on the distal side of the ball and socket joints. And you've taken out the pain triggers. Now all of a sudden you've restored their training volume and they're back in the game. So I've taken a very athletic example. And then we've also given an example from everyday living. Well, let's take a gymnast now. someone who has to really flex their back to do their athletic job. You got to learn to do that in a way where if you really are moving the spine around, you can't have high load at the same time. It will restrict the total cycles that the spine can take. What's that magic number? Well, that's a political discussion now. It's not biologically relevant to that individual. But you will find with provocative testing where that number lies for that particular individual and come up with the most clever training regimen around that injury and pain mechanism so they can still achieve their athletic goals. Anyway, it all depends on who we're talking about. Are we talking about me that all I got to do is get through life now with my joints as intact and as pain-free and as less arthritic as possible and still have enough wherewithal where I can do my job, versus someone who is younger, they still have their joints and they can really train and they enjoy it. That's their gig. But they'll enjoy it longer the more they can spare them.
I guess what I liked, Stu, is that it used to haunt me at night. And the same thing, I remember it's coming up on the 7-year anniversary for when I actually thought up weighted hip thrusts to use a barbell for doing hip thrusts. It was October 12th, 2006, and that's coming up. And I used to, I always knew it was a good glute exercise, but I didn't know, I'm going to have all my girls do this for their glutes, and they liked it. But then I started getting, I had a gym, and I started getting all these people one by one coming up to me saying, "Hey, Brett, I'm running faster than I've ever ran before." And it's that hip thrust. It's, that's why I'm running faster. It's the hip thrust. And I'd go, we do like 20 different lower body exercises. We're doing Bulgarian split squats. We're doing, I'd start listing off the exercise. How do you know it's the hip thrust? Because I feel my glute working in the same manner that it does when I do the hip thrust. I actually feel my glutes when I run. And I'd sit there and go, well, why wouldn't they say that about the squat? What's different between the squat and the hip thrust? And we take this for granted, Stu, now that we have this advanced understanding of biomechanics, and we can say, well, it's going to change the hip extension torque angle curve, and we understand all this stuff now. But back then, I didn't have this great biomechanical understanding. I would stay awake at night and think and just think and think and think. And the same thing happened with crunches. I sit there and go, how can some people tolerate these how come everyone's spine isn't, like, discs aren't obliterated? If the flexion cycles, we all go through so many of them, and yeah, you could say, well, it's not creating the compressive load under those, under that cycle. But I just have such a curiosity, and I think about things. Like, I think about, okay, when you're laying down in a crunch, there's two points of contact, your sacrum and your mid-back. And connected to the floor. Maybe when you do the crunch, those are resisting compression because there's two points of contact and you're not getting the compression. Because I've seen studies by, I think it was, started with a G, Goal or something, did as many flexion cycles, like 100,000 flexion cycles, but with no compressive load, the spine could tolerate it. There was no damage to the discs. You need the compressive load and the range of motion. And I think of all these things, and I wonder, I think about them biomechanically and physiologically, and do discs repair? Wolf's Law states that soft tissue, gets stronger. But I also hear you say the discs don't repair that well. It's this cumulative trauma, I think this is what's nice is that we have demonstrated here that hell. I tell people when they ask me questions, I say, I might like people to use a little bit of posterior pelvic tilt at the end range of a hip thrust or when they lock out a deadlift. You like neutral spine, neutral pelvis. When people ask me a question, I'll say, here's what I think, but I also listen to Stu McGill, and I have no problem admitting that you know more than me about the spine. And so it just shows a good case of how two people can get along. Because we both trust each other's intent. We both trust that we're evidence-based and we're looking at the evidence. We're not just trying to be these gurus who make black and bold black and white statements. And it's a nice demonstration of how two people can get along well. Are two smart people? Have you ever agreed with any person on every single topic? But I do. Hell, you've taught me so much, Stu, about spinal biomechanics, and most of what I've learned in this area is from you. So it just shows that we can have differences in opinion, but we agree on most things. Of course, that sedentary guy who has mid back pain, I'm not going to give that guy crunches. Hell, I don't even give a lot of crunches. I just think about these things. But I remember, just to demonstrate a case where it's important to be evidence-based, in my crunch article, I did mention that it's important to expose the disc to, if you're going to be doing flexion, you want to be doing extension too, and it can balance out it can balance things out. And I remember reading a study by someone, it was one of your students, and it showed that adding extension to the flexion equation actually made matters worse. It exacerbated it fast-forwarded the symptoms, so I was wrong there. So anyway, I think this is a good example of how you and I get along well. We can hang out, have great discussions. We don't have to agree on everything. The industry likes to paint two people against each other when we both admit there's gray area, and heck, I totally appreciate your viewpoint on things. So with that, I will leave the listeners to the last question, and this pertains to your mustache and whether or not you've ever shaved it off. You told me a funny story about that. Can you relay that to the listeners?
Yeah. Well, was that the one where, I have a daughter who's a kind of a daddy's girl, and then she came to me, Dad, and said, Dad, why don't you shave your mustache off? You know, I thought about that for no more than 30 milliseconds just because she said it. And, you know, my wife's mentioned that over the years because I don't think I've ever been clean shaven since I was about 18. I've either had some awful beard or, you know, through the 70s, those awful sideburns and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, so I shaved it off and I was really quite unrecognizable. But as I learned afterwards, I would go and do a clinical course, or someone would fly me in somewhere, and they were so disappointed. The mustache, I came to learn, was part of the gig, and that's what they wanted. So I grew it back, and now that's all part of whatever this McGill thing is.
But it's part of your brand. I agree.
Yeah.
I'd be very annoyed at you if I flew you out to do a seminar and you had shaved your mustache. I'd go, part of the equation, you know. That's what we've come to expect from you. That's so funny, though.
Can I echo just one, that last point you made before the mustache thing, though?
Of course. I didn't give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, what you said, that's just a great way to finish this up. It's funny, you know. I know you will have your admirers and disciples, and there are some disciples of...
Well, you've got more than me, so I'll have...
But there are disciples of other people as well, and what the listeners, I hope they understand, is, you know, it doesn't matter whether I'm with you or Pavel or Dan John or back in the old days of Mel Siff or Zatsiorsky or Grakovetsky or any of these people. We were all good friends. And we enjoyed one another, and we enjoyed debating, and it was over a beer and peanuts. And we knew one another's kids, all of these things. And they came and stayed at houses, just like you did. You know, I remember staying at Mel's house. Wonderful time. But it's the disciples that they're ready to kill someone who would dare challenge who they perceived as being a leader or a guru. And I wish all that would go away. You know, George St. Pierre, who you know, I'm quite a fan of as just an outstanding individual. He has a quote, something about, I honor my opponents because they define me. Without my opponents, I'm nothing. And you know, we started out this conversation talking about our battles with Grakovetsky and whatnot. We quite enjoyed one another. He called me up after all those battles were finished, maybe say somewhere in the mid 90s, and he said, "Stu," he says, "you know, I hope you don't hate me, and I hope there was nothing personal." And I said, no, of course not. Of course, at the time, they were stressful, and these letters to the editor and things were stressful. But it's all part of your forging, and it's all part of becoming who you are. I talked about some of the great personalities. All of them, when you look back, had such a great role to play in developing all of us. And with yourself, I met you for the first time a couple of weeks ago. I enjoyed it so much. We had wonderful conversations. I've enjoyed this evening. And I hope people just get all of that. This is all about friendship, and we're all trying to seek the truth.
And we're all working to try to maximize our understanding and advance the field, and I hope, Stu, I hope that we can do more stuff together over time. It's been a pleasure. I hope you stick around and I get my PhD and I'll call you up and say, "Did you hear what this person's saying? We gotta look at this," or something, you know. But anyway, I know
you have to call you Dr. Contreras.
Yes, you will.
Okay.
Hold on, Stu. It's Dr. Contreras.
That's my honor. I'll be very pleased on that day.
But anyway, since we both lost the battle, I look forward to now I have to buy you a beer and you have to buy me a beer with our EMG bet. So look forward to that next time we meet up, Stu. So thank you very, very much for coming on. We're on 3 hours now, so this was great. I told you it'd be a long interview, but we'd get through all of it. And I hope I'm sure the readers will very much appreciate this. So thank you so much for your time. How can... If my readers want to learn more about your stuff, where can they access your books and DVDs and things like that? And talk about that real quick.
All the information is synthesized on some books that I've tried to put together and DVDs. They're at backfitpro.com. Just as it sounds, BACKFITPRO, backfitpro.com. So, Brett, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.